When it comes to management and preservation of cultural heritage and records, one size does not fit all. That's why the San Jose State University School of Information offers not just one, but two 100% online master's degree programs that focus on archives and records management. Customize your studies in the Master of Archives and Records Administration or Master of Library and Information Science program. Visit iSchool.sjsu.edu.
From the Society of American Archivists, this is Archives in Context, a podcast highlighting archival literature and technologies, and most importantly, the people behind them.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Archives in Context podcast. I'm Nicole Milano, and I'm here with co-host Joyellen Williams.
Hi, everyone.
Today, we're excited to be speaking with Dr. Jesse Ryan Erickson, author of The Gentleman's Ghost, Patriarchal Eurocentric Legacies and Special Collections Design, published in 2020 in Mary Candiac's book, Archives and Special Collections as Sites of Contestation, by Library Juice Press. The Gentleman's Ghost examines special collections reading rooms within the context of the history of libraries, which he states, quote, encompass an infrastructure that was founded upon hierarchical, colonial, and exclusionary modalities of power, end quote. Welcome, Jesse.
Hello, hello.
Thank you so much for joining us. For those of our listeners who may not know you, here's a little background. Jesse Ryan Erickson is the curator of printed books and bindings at the Morgan Library and Museum. He earned his bachelor's, master's of library and information science, and doctorate in information studies from the University of California, Los Angeles. Thanks again for being here with us today, Jesse. Let's start with, how did you find your way into the profession?
Oh, well, you know, thanks for asking. I mean, I recounted my origin story many times now, so it may be familiar to some of your listeners, but it's an interesting one, and, you know, I could probably fill the podcast with the details, so I'll try to, you know, be as brief as possible, but essentially, you know, I decided to be a rare book librarian as a young student. I was in community college at the time, and I was, you know, I had studied dance before, and it didn't really work out, wasn't the best fit. So, you know, I was in this place in my life where, you know, I was trying to figure out what I was going to do. And I realized that, you know, books were always a really important part of my life, and I spent a lot of my youth in the library. And so libraries stood out to me, and it just seemed like my calling, right? And as I was investigating, you know, how one becomes a librarian, I learned I had to go back to school and get a master's. And it was the same year that California Rare Book School was opening up. And then this sent me back to my high school years, where my mother and I would go to the Huntington Library a lot. My mother loved the gardens, and naturally I fell in love with the library there. And it just occurred to me that, you know, the rare books, this whole world of rare books, that there was a path to pursue a career in which I could work in a place like the Huntington. And this was really, really exciting prospect for me. So it lit a fire under me. And at that point, I became committed to that goal of pursuing that career and doing whatever it took to make it in that field. And the rest was really history. At that point, it was a really strategic decision to, you know, pursue every opportunity that was available to me, start studying, you know, what I would need to know. And, you know, I'm very grateful for those who helped lift me up along the way. I had just tremendous mentors from the time that I was a clerk in the Central Library of the Los Angeles Public Library. And throughout, you know, my internship at the Getty and working at UCLA, just numerous mentors along the way that really kind of helped me along, and I really couldn't have done it without them.
You've given us an idea of the role that libraries have played in your life, even from a young age. So what aspect of your work has been most meaningful to you and why?
I love that question, you know. I mean, obviously I love the collections, but to me, like, collections, they're a means to an end, right? So I'm less interested in simply developing a collection for, say, like, the purpose of building prestige or something like that. You know, having artifacts, like, sit on the shelves, just collecting dust. And I've done, you know, a backlog inventory. So I know that backlog issues are real. You know, sometimes we get these collections and they just sit on the shelves for years and years. It's getting better, but yeah, those issues are still there. But to me, I think what's most important and most meaningful is sort of the opportunity to expand the boundaries of how we define knowledge, how we understand knowledge. You know, most importantly, I'm interested in how we could advance the production of knowledge, right? So to me, it's all about knowledge and learning, and that's really been the most meaningful aspect of this work to me.
So Jesse, we want to turn now to The Gentleman's Ghost. The position piece opens with the sentence, quote, "Special collections reading rooms inherited by research libraries across the Western world were designed for white men," end quote. When did you start thinking critically about special collections reading rooms, and what prompted you to write the piece?
Well, to be honest, I actually started this work back when I was doing my dissertation research, and my dissertation on, you know, the kind of the ways that we can rethink how we look at Black literacy practices, and specifically in the context of special collections libraries as research environments. You know, these questions really started to come up, and it made me think about, you know, the personal experiences that I had going back, you know, to my time at the Huntington, where, you know, I sort of was overcome by feelings of both awe, right, but then also sort of intimidated in these spaces. And then, you know, as a community college student, I started to begin doing bibliographical research, learning about what that, you know, entailed in special collections, right? And one of the first libraries I visited was the Clark Library, which really got me thinking about these questions, because the William Andrews Clark Library, which is a part of UCLA, it lives in an area which is, over time, become a Black and Brown community, essentially, right? And so there's this interesting juxtaposition of what the Clark is and what it represents and the community that it lives in now. I think there's been tremendous improvements in the relationship of the Clark to the surrounding community over the, you know, the past decade or so. But for years and years and years, at least from, you know, folks that I've talked to that, you know, lived around or in the area, or, you know, knew something about, you know, the area, there was a lot of mystery surrounding the library itself. The people in the community didn't really know what it is. And so, you know, my own experience of visiting these spaces and the intimidation that I felt in these spaces really kind of prompted me to rethink these through these issues. You know, and it all goes back to, you know, your previous question about what's most meaningful to me. You know, I've always been really fascinated by the sort of epistemological dimensions of knowing, you know, especially now given that the concept of justifiable truth has been pretty much cast aside, and perhaps irrevocably so, but, you know, I talk a lot about the power of branding and marketing knowledge and learning in a more attractive way. But I think we need to really kind of work through ways to break down the barriers between learning, right, and what it means to sort of be entertained, right? And I get so much pleasure from reading and consuming other content and having conversations and my daily interactions, and I think maybe we all do. So when I entered a space like the one you find in the William Andrews Clark Library, sort of all these questions started popping up in my mind as it pertains to, you know, how do these spaces impact the way that we learn? How do these spaces sort of change the dimensions of how we internalize and acquire and engage with knowledge, right? So it all kind of links back to each other.
For those who have not read the piece, how would you summarize which aspects of our spaces might impact the subjective experience of doing research?
So, yeah, I mean, I really think, like, literally every aspect of the interior, right, would sort of have an impact on the subjective experience of doing research. And I mean everything from the color scheme, right, to the lighting, to decisions around, you know, whether there's carpet or not, what does that carpet look like, are there ornamental rugs, right, paintings especially that you see around you, oftentimes there are busts, right, and I mean, it was clear to me that there was a trend across numerous libraries that I was visiting, and that trend was modeled off of this sort of idea of what a gentleman's study would look like, right? And that seemed to be sort of the standard. Now, you know, there's a lot of variation there, but you see a lot of those, you see a lot of the aspects of that visual lexicon come into play. And, you know, it's really a difficult thing to pinpoint the various ways in which these design decisions will have an impact on the ways that we conduct our research, the research process. But even things like the positioning of the table, what kind of chairs you have, whether there's multiple chairs in the space, you know, whether these tables are separated off. I mean, all these things can really have an effect on, you know, the potential for doing different kinds of research than what's typically expected in a special collections reading room.
We interviewed, or we spoke with Dr. Ashley Farmer a few seasons ago about many of these same topics and how the paintings on the wall, the busts that are displayed in these reading rooms, how they impact really the welcomeness of a space for many researchers. So these are really, really important points that you write about. You also write at one point in the piece that, quote, institutional racism in particular functions through a profound cultural embeddedness that has outlasted much of the intentionality of its human agency, end quote. You also state that the vestiges of the past must be confronted. What actions do you hope will result from the position piece?
Well, I mean, honestly, when I wrote the piece and even in doing my dissertation research and writing a chapter on these same issues, the goal was really simply to start conversations, you know, such as this one, and conversations that would at least get us beyond sort of an uncritical adherence to these design conventions, which I think are deeply embedded in our field. That's really the goal, is just to really start conversations and get us thinking through. And I hope that, you know, in having these conversations, people will start to kind of have different ideas of different ways of doing things. And, you know, over time, perhaps those ideas will come to fruition.
Now, for many archivists, the reality of implementing physical changes to reading rooms can be very challenging. There may be high-profile donors who prefer the traditional experience, for example, or the archivists struggle with a lack of resources. What are your suggestions for archivists who may not have the institutional buy-in or the resources to implement true physical change, but have the desire to? Which steps forward can they begin to take?
Well, thank you for that question in particular, because although I've been critical of these spaces sort of throughout my career and my education, you know, I also really, really value, you know, some of the more conventional reading room spaces. And, you know, I kind of fear sometimes that gets lost in the piece. You know, they can be extremely aesthetically beautiful, of course, and awe-inspiring. And I think there's a value to their historicity and their ability to sort of inspire. So I don't think that the gentleman's studies should be the default for interior design in all cases. And I think that, you know, other design models may be a better fit for other institutions and organizations, particularly those that service underserved or minoritized populations, right? But there are situations that I know of where there's, you know, donor preferences for tradition, have a lot of sway. And I think in those cases, those traditions can and probably should be upheld. It's a matter of being, to me at least, it's a matter of being accountable, being transparent, and really kind of being reparative with the contextualization of these spaces when you're dealing with situations like that. So you can always begin, you can always start there with that sort of accountability, right? That transparency. And that's being transparent about the history of how those spaces came to be and what they represent. So I think community outreach can go a long way, and you can do a lot with curatorial practice in the way that you confront perhaps problematic histories that these spaces may be tied to. A number of universities, major universities even across the country, have reached a point to where they're starting to unearth these buried ties to gender based and racial violence and other forms of injustice that have been, I think, over time purposefully perhaps obscured by the more sanitized narratives that for years have just been accepted prima facie. But so I think there's, we're experiencing a shift in that regard. And certainly, even on the campus I work off, we have the UD's anti-racist initiative that's starting to ask those questions about, ties to the history of racial injustice on our campus. And so, we're part of sort of a larger movement. So that's, that's the transparency, that's the accountability, and then the reparative work comes with that. And it's part of that racial reckoning, I think. But there's always more that can be done to improve relations by really just acknowledging these histories.
You wrote, "Theory opens the door for long-term structural change that should and must occur over time," and quote bell hooks's statement on theory and practice. Could you share what that means to you and which theories most underpin your work?
Yeah, I mean, it's really a question of praxis that has informed so much of our work that's rooted in Black feminist theory, of course, Black feminist thought. But something that I eventually came to understand while I was in graduate school is that, theory starts with the scholarship and then it's woven into the pedagogy and it moves its way through the field in policymaking discourses, those policymaking discourses that occur in committees and board meetings, right? Eventually shaping the decisions of administrators and directors, right? And making its way to, the practice of faculty and staff, right? But I'm aware that it's not unidirectional, of course, right? I mean, it's not always sort of a top-down thing. It can be bottom-up, top-down, and everything in between. But there is a certain flow to the exchange of ideas and how they become realized in professional practice, right? So to me, I remember that in graduate school there was, because I was in a library program that focused on the master's, right, that was very professional practice based, and then a PhD program that was very much invested in theory and ideas. And, sort of going through the program and seeing it through to the doctorate, I remember there was a lot of back and forth about, the value of theory in sort of the professional practice classes, right? It seems to me that there was a sort of a dichotomy there, right, among the student body, where, folks that were in the doctoral program were sometimes less interested in, the professional practice, and then you know, folks that were in the master's program were less interested in theory. But to me, they were always sort of interwoven and integral to each other. So this is something that I've always pretty much maintained. And I think that, you know, whether you're looking at professional practice, right, or you're looking at theory, they all kind of affect one another. And so for me, I mean, there are some theoretical and meta-theoretical frameworks that have had a tremendous influence in my way of thinking and approaching the field. The three that probably have had the most impact are Afro-pessimism, strategic presentism, and retrofuturism. And these ideas kind of circulate throughout all my work, so I go back to them again and again in sort of a constant refrain.
Now, Jesse, we know that you also work in the digital realm. What can we learn from the history you shared and how it might apply to the still emerging digital spaces and virtual reading rooms, which have especially impacted us during the COVID-19 pandemic?
Absolutely. And I'm really interested in that concept of interiority. And the pandemic really pushed my thinking in that regard, because I taught a lot on Zoom, and I even taught a class on critical bibliography where we were learning descriptive bibliography, and I had to think through ways of teaching that remotely. And I employed, you know, sort of low-tech VR, low-tech virtual reality, the kind of cardboard VR, as a way to really dive into the interiorities of the digital spaces, right? Because I saw it as an opportunity to explore the sort of elasticity of the ways in which we look at spatiality itself, right? But digital spaces, I find they kind of often follow in the same direction, right, as our analog and other kind of spaces, right? I mean, they fall into the same traps, you know, falling into the same sort of design templates that are informed by convention. And I think what I mean is, like, the information architecture of these spaces, they face many of the same limitations. As you know, when we're employing interior design in a reading room, I perhaps I should give an example. I remember when Web 1.0, this is a long time ago, Web 1.0 used to try to, like, emulate the world of paper documents, very, very text heavy, right? A much different digital space than Web 2.0 and beyond. But it makes me think of terms like web page, right, and issues for e-magazines, and, you know, the sort of vestiges of the paper-based world and how it migrated into these digital spaces. So there's a conversation to be had about, you know, the relationship between our digital spaces and spaces that we interact with in the quote-unquote physical world. I tend to think of the digital as material, so I don't like to create a binary between you know, digital environments and environments that we interact with in person, because the digital is just another form of material. And I think a lot of the language around the digital kind of makes it seem like it almost exists somewhere else when it exists with us. I think more than that, there's a number of scholars have noted. I'm thinking of Sophia Noble now. People bring their biases to the design, right, of these spaces, and it feeds into algorithms of content creation and even information retrieval. So we really have to be critical about how we design our digital spaces, right? And we have to kind of think through the same questions as we would in a reading room about the sort of design conventions that are embedded in the platforms that sometimes we don't even have the option of changing, right? Why this color scheme is being used over that one and the like, or why we're choosing this template over another. And, that kind of critical questioning, I think, will go a long way in sort of addressing the issue of the same problems that we are finding in the reading room space cropping up in the ways that we design digital spaces.
That's absolutely fascinating. And you end the piece by inviting readers to imagine alternate reading rooms, like pop-ups and one designed for a hip-hop archive. So, with our final question, we also invite you to do some imagining. What superpower would you most like to have and why?
I mean, if I've learned anything from reading comic books and manga, and I'm a fan of both, love manga, but what you learn is superpowers are kind of like curses, you know, because they always come with unforeseen consequences. So, yeah, I mean, I would, if there were the powers that be that were going to, you know, grant me with some kind of superpower, I probably would try to wish it away or you know, take the X-Men approach of being like, I don't want this in my life. But no. In all seriousness, I, to be honest, I often view my literacy practice as something of a superpower, you know, because I learned that my desire for learning has transformed my life so much for the better, right? And this goes all the way back to my youth, you know. I remember just in my youngest years, you know, as I became a better reader and we got our first encyclopedia set, and just going through and just picking topics and learning about this and learning about that. I mean, of course, you know, looking back, the encyclopedia entries were very problematic and biased in numerous ways, so I can read them with different eyes, of course. But no, I mean, just that I had sort of insatiable desire for, pursuing that intellectual curiosity and the literacy practice that I was able to acquire very much supported that, and I really don't take that for granted. So, I mean, I have to say, reading is a superpower. You know, it really is, and it's something that's overlooked, and I definitely don't overlook that. So yeah, I would have to say, just reading.
Well, that's a very appropriate superpower given your work. So good answer. So thank you so much for speaking with us today, Jesse. We hope you enjoyed sharing your perspectives with us as much as we enjoyed hearing them. You've given us so many insightful points to think about after today's conversation, including how we can expand the boundaries of how we advance knowledge. So thank you so much for listening, everyone. Until next time, happy reading.
Thank you.
You've just listened to an episode of Archives in Context, the official podcast of the Society of American Archivists. Members of the podcast team include Bethany Anderson, Chris Burns, Mary Caldera, Nicole Milano, Lolita Rowe, Anna Trammell, and Joyellen Williams. Opinions expressed in this podcast are our own and are not reflective of a particular institution. Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes if you enjoyed what you heard, and join us again next time.